Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're always hearing about the Constitution these days, but what do we really know about it and how it affects our everyday lives? That's what Peter Sagal, the star of NPR's popular Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, decided to find out and share with PBS viewers in a four-hour series to premiere May 7th on PBS. Peter Sagal is with us now to talk about the series. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Oh, my pleasure to be with you, Ann.
When I read that more than a third of Americans can't name the three branches of government, I thought, we're in some kind of trouble. But you said your intention here is not a civic lesson like that, the sort that teaches us about the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branches, if you'll let me brag there for a second.
I'll give you a little gold star.
So what was the intention?
The intention of this documentary is really to explore how the Constitution is working today, because we tend to think of it as this sort of historical document handed down to us via funny men in white wigs many years ago, and that it's this thing that reigns from on high and we can cite it in our argument when we want to prove that the person we're talking to is being dumb. And it doesn't work that way. It actually works very vividly, very actively, very importantly today. It's happening right now. The fact that the government can't keep us from having this conversation, no matter what I say about it, is a constitutional issue. The fact that, you know, you're affiliated with Ohio State University, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a state university. That means that the government of Ohio is taxing and spending to provide education. That's a constitutional issue, and on and on and on. And we really wanted to talk to people who were caught up in constitutional issues, sometimes against their will, but often people who are fighting fights in the constitutional arena right now, to show people this ain't a dead document. It's alive. It's working or failing to work even as we speak.
You wanted to find out how it unites us as a nation just at a time when so many people feel like we're at completely loose ends.
Ain't that true?
Yeah.
And that's true. You know, people have said, you know, that the interest in the Constitution has arisen recently with the rise of the Tea Party, which often cites the Constitution and says that the current administration is violating it. But that's not unique. I mean, prior to that, a lot of people thought the Bush administration was violating the Constitution in different ways. So basically, for the last decade or more, half the country has thought that the other half of the country doesn't know what the Constitution means and is violating it. And I actually don't think that's a bad thing that people are so upset about the Constitution and what they feel their opponents are doing, because I'd rather have the argument about the Constitution than with guns, which is the historic way of settling political differences. And the Constitution is there to allow us to have these arguments. So let's have them.
I thought it was interesting that you traveled to Iceland, where leaders there turned to the U.S. Constitution for inspiration in reimagining a new Constitution for themselves. Why'd you go there? Why are they doing that?
Well, it's an interesting question. Our Constitution is 225 years old, and it's very, very hard to change, and it's a very, very venerated document. So we never ask ourselves, should we start again? Does it still work? I mean, there's no other Constitution in the world that's lasted that long, and maybe that's because there's a reason. You know, maybe they wear out after a while, like batteries. In Iceland, what happened was they were very much affected by the global financial collapse in 2008. Their economy collapsed. With it went their government, you know, their had new elections. But some people in Iceland thought that wasn't enough, that they needed to change their constitution. And they had a modern constitutional convention. They put it on Facebook. They tweeted it. They had people Skype in suggestions. You know, it was very different than our forefathers locked in that airless room in Philadelphia two centuries ago. And one of the things they did was they looked to our Constitution for inspiration. Among the things they did was to build in limits on what the government could do, which has never seemed like a very good idea to other countries at times, because why would you keep the government from doing necessary things? But our forefathers had the wisdom or foolishness to say the government shouldn't be able to do certain things because it's too much of a danger. I'm sad to say I just heard the news, though, that this new constitution was defeated in a popular referendum in Iceland, though it was a good try, and it was fun to talk to them about it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Peter Sagal. He's the host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, but we're talking now about his new PBS series. It is set to premiere May 7th, It's called Constitution USA with Peter Sagal, A More Perfect Union. If you have a question or comment for Peter, give us a call right away, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Do not delay. He'll be with us for just a few more minutes. In one episode, Peter, you talk with OSU Law Professor Michelle Alexander about contemporary Jim Crow.
Yeah, we do. We went there to Columbus. We met with her in downtown. As you know, Michelle Alexander is a law professor there. Mm-hmm. And Michelle believes and has evidence to back it up that because primarily of a weird little loophole in the Fifth Amendment that the vote cannot be denied, in the 15th Amendment, the vote can't be denied except for conviction of a crime, mm-hmm. that there's a whole underclass of people in this country, felons, both current and ex-felons, who aren't allowed to vote by their states, and further, that because of the drug war, which has disproportionately affected African Americans in the inner cities and created a huge prisoner class among them, that there's this basically whole underclass of people who don't have any rights, who can't vote, who don't have the franchise. And that, she believes, is an intentional act by the ruling power structure. Her explanation for their motives and their actions will stand on its own. It's certainly true that most people are surprised to discover that you can have your right to vote taken away from you upon the conviction of a felony and never restored. We met in addition to Michelle, we also talked to an activist named Connor Fogel in Kentucky, an ex-felon herself who was pardoned by the governor and got her franchise back, who was working with the fervor of an evangelist to change law in Kentucky, which currently prevents felons from voting for the rest of their lives.
So it's a state-by-state thing, then?
It is, but the power to deny the right to vote, mm-hmm. comes from the federal constitution. It allows states to do that, and many of them have chosen to do so. There are many states, Michelle pointed this out to me, where the population of a prison, which can be tens of thousands of people, counts toward the local representative district, i.e., a congressman purports to represent those people in Congress, yet those people cannot vote for that congressman or woman.
You were telling me earlier that you started working on this or thinking about it in 2010.
We first discussed it.
And so it seems like by 2013, you must know everything about the Constitution. But as you moved forward through this process, what surprised you the most about the Constitution?
What surprised me most about it was that it was so short. It's the shortest constitution currently in the world and also the longest lived. I don't think that that's coincidental, but both those things are true. It surprised me how ambiguous it is. And it's intentionally ambiguous. As Akhil Rita Mar of Yale pointed out to me, when they wanted to be specific, their founders were specific. They didn't say, for example, that the president has to be mature enough to hold the office. They said he has to be 35. But they did say things like Congress shall have the right to pass all laws necessary and proper. What does that mean? They said that a president can be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors. What does that mean? They said in the Eighth Amendment that you can't have cruel and unusual punishment. What does that mean? And, obviously we've argued about what those things have meant for centuries. And I would tell you that they wanted us to, that they left it ambiguous because they didn't want to put shackles on posterity, to use their word, in terms of what we needed to do as a self-governing people. They wanted us to figure it out for ourselves.
And that in and of itself is probably the visionary genius of the whole thing.
Yeah, I think so. I think a less enlightened group of men who trusted their fellow citizens less than they did would have made sure that we were ruled by their will through posterity. And they knew, having just been through a rebellion themselves against the king, that we, their children and children's children, wouldn't have stood for their dictatorship either, even though, it was done through law. They wanted us, the American people, to be self-governing, and they gave us the freedom to do that.
So you use the stories that we're hearing about in the news to frame the episodes. What topics are going to be covered over the course of the four episodes?
Well, the four episodes are divided into four themes, four broad themes. They are federalism, we always lead with what's sexy, then equality, then rights, and then staying power, meaning does the Constitution, as we've been discussing, mm-hmm. still have what it takes to exist in the modern world? Iceland threw out theirs, or they tried to, because they thought it didn't. Does ours? It's very different from every other constitution in the world. Other newer constitutions don't follow our model of a tricameral government. They have a parliamentary system, which they feel is more efficient. Is ours screwed up? A lot of people think it is. A lot of people look at our current mess and think that our Constitution is outdated with its House and its Senate and its President and Electoral College and its judiciary and all this mess. Wouldn't it be easier to have a parliament where the head of state is the head of the legislature? Stuff gets done.
What are some of the characters that we're going to see that inspired you? First of all, why did you pick a motorcycle painted red, white, and blue to shoot across the country in?
What do you ride when you go look for America?
I'm afraid it would tip over and crush me, but...
I know. I mean, what are you going to do, take a Civic? Honestly, nothing wrong with the good people of Honda, who I think build their automobiles in Ohio, but, you know, it's all about the symbolism here. If you're going to go look for America, you got to go in a gaily painted Harley Davidson.
But did you wear a helmet?
Oh, of course I wore a helmet.
Okay.
Government approved. In fact, you know, one thing we didn't do, but we meant to do, is to ride up to a border of a state and put on the helmet, because helmet laws change. It's
right.
Federalism in action. So, yeah, that's why we took the Harley. We met one day in Phoenix, speaking of helmets, we met with Sandra Day O'Connor, former Supreme Court Justice, and we met with the Arizona Leathernecks Motorcycle Club, which is a group of Marines who ride around motorcycles with their tattoos and leather. And, you know, and interestingly enough, both Sandra Day O'Connor and Kong, the founder of the motorcycle club, both had copies of the Constitution in their pockets, which I thought was awesome. We met with gun activists in Montana, Ethiopian refugees in Minneapolis. We met with experts of every stripe. We met with cannabis, a medical marijuana dispenser in California, and Chris Perry, who wants to marry her partner Sandy Steer and has filed suit in the Supreme Court to get that right under the Constitution. We met with a guy whose house was bulldozed in New London because of a Supreme Court case and a notorious one called Kelo versus New London. And we met with one of the Little Rock Nine, a woman named Minnie Jean Brown, now Minnie Jean Brown Tricky. And we reunited her with a member of the 101st Airborne who escorted her to school in 1957 with rifles and bayonets to protect her from her fellow citizens. It was pretty amazing.
I was thinking that it seems like there's so much going on now constitutionally in this country, but when I listen to the array of topics and people that you're talking to, it's always been going on.
It has. I mean, this is an ongoing drama. And one of the things that I like to say is that in regard to the living constitution or original constitution, you can argue that we should govern ourselves according to the original intent of the Constitution. We should read the Constitution as it was originally intended, to the extent that you can figure that out. They're all dead, of course. They can't tell us. But you can argue that that's what we've done. We have been engaged in an ongoing debate about what the Constitution means and has meant over the course of the history of our country. We have radically changed our understanding of what it means in areas large and small, from what cruel and unusual punishment might be to what equal protection of the laws means. So, like I said, this is not a dead document. It is alive in every interaction we have with each other and the government and the public sphere.
Well, I look forward to seeing the show. Peter Sagal, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Great to talk to you, Ann.
Peter Sagal, he's the host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. His new PBS series is called Constitution USA with Peter Sagal, A More Perfect Union. The first show in the series, Constitution USA with Peter Sagal, A More Perfect Union, will be airing on WOSU-TV tomorrow, May 7th at 9 p.m. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. 55 degrees with some light rain. There is a chance of a shower for today, about a 40% chance. Maybe a pop-up thunderstorm and a high near 70. Still that slight chance of rain for tonight, about a 30% chance, a low of 54. And the chance of rain sticks around for Tuesday, a high of 73. Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series. And support comes from the Wellington School, where fearless learning is celebrated in preschool through grade 12. The Wellington School will host an information session for prospective parents on Wednesday, May 8th at 9 a.m. More at wellington.org. And All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Marital bliss, most of us know that as an ideal, it doesn't exist. Or maybe it does, but it's different for every couple. But it probably doesn't, at least as our next guest tells it in his new memoir, Life in a Marital Institution, 20 Years of Monogamy in One Terrifying Memoir. James Brawley's autobiographical stories have been broadcast nationally on This American Life, The Moth Radio Hour, Selected Shorts, NPR, and Marketplace. His personal essays have appeared in the New York Times, among other places, and he also performs his stories. So far, his monologue, Life in a Marital Institution, has played more than 200 performances, and he joins us today. Welcome to the show, James Brawley.
Thanks so much, and I really appreciate you having me.
In some of the PR material, it suggested that memoirs and novels about long-term relationships primarily illuminate the female audience. And all I could think of is that growing up, all the male humorists and stand-up comics over the years far outnumbered the women. And they always were using their poor wives and families as fodder for their stories.
Well, that's true. But that doesn't mean that I can't say something that's not true in my PR material.
Okay. It's PR material.
On a more serious note, I think, yes, you're right. More comics are male than though they're traditionally comics have been male. Traditionally, they've used their domestic situations as fodder. I think what's different in a memoir versus stand-up is that you're trying to get to some emotional truth or density that you may not be trying to get to in stand-up. And that typically has been the domain of female memoirists.
When you're doing a memoir, did you start the monologues before you started the memoir, or how did that coincide or not?
Yes, I started because I was in the midst of a marriage, of a relationship I didn't understand. And, you know, there are two schools of thought when writing. One is write what you know, and the other is write what you want to learn about. And I wanted to learn about my marriage and why I had chosen this situation, because nobody puts a gun to your head. Well, mm-hmm. Most of the time they don't anyway, in a marriage. And I thought, you know, why is this happening? And so I started to write about it to see whether I could decode my personal situation. And as I developed my, you know, stories and craft and audience and so forth, it expanded into something more than that.
How do you maintain a sense of authenticity? How do you really tell the truth about your life? It has to be very scary.
It is. It actually is. And when I, you know, going back to your previous question, my initial objective, for want of a better word, was I'm a chooser. I'm not a victim. At the end of this process, I'm going to find out why I'm choosing this situation and we're both going to live happily ever after. And in the course of developing it in that way, a Tony Award-winning director happened to be in the audience one night, a very small audience, and he walked up to me afterwards and said, and asked him for his thoughts. And he said, well, here, you know, in a nutshell, you're going to have to change your writing if you want to keep doing this, because you get to tell your stories on stage because most people in the audience are afraid to tell theirs. And they want to go to that place in their emotional lives that they're afraid of through you. And if you can't do that, you can't do this work. And I said, so basically you're telling me that I'm at a fork in the road and I have to choose between my personal life and my artistic life. I said, well, it's not that melodramatic, but you do have to be willing to go to a place where at the end of your show, people think, oh my God, he's going home and getting divorced. So now this was a guy who was unmarried. And easy for him to say.
All right.
But it was it did raise a question that others also raised subsequent to him. And ultimately, I decided that if I wasn't going to do this work, that I, you know, I had to be willing to go to some uncomfortable places.
Jane, your wife, how did she feel about it?
Well, as you may have gleaned from my book, we really occupied two independent spheres. The Venn diagram overlap became increasingly small, so that, you know, she was living in an upstate kind of leftist meat-eating biosphere where I was visiting on the weekends from my storage unit. I'd sold our apartment in the city and lived in a storage unit to change careers, and then visited on the weekends. And so she was not really exposed to the developmental process, you know, as I was figuring it out. And it was a volatile process, volatile in the sense that on a Monday, this story might come out as a love story, and on a Tuesday, it might come out as something altogether different. And then when it finally evened out over time, you know, I spent years developing it. Mm-hmm. At that point, she viewed it largely, you know, to her credit, leaving aside the content, as something that I was really passionate about. And she was super passionate about motherhood, and her position was, you know what, I love my job as a mother. So, and I was the breadwinner, so it seems reasonable that you should find a job you love. And ultimately, I did.
This was such a rare moment of agreement.
Yeah, there were others. I mean, here's the thing. It's I think it was Gandhi who said history is the record of what went wrong, or maybe he was referring to the newspapers. You know, the news is a record of what went wrong yesterday. So the moments where you do, or more than moments, where you agree, don't necessarily make for an interesting or engaging, instructive, entertaining story. There were moments of agreement, and continue to be moments of agreement, but the disagreements were significant and frequent. And I felt like that was the turf that I was entering into as a writer and a storyteller and a performer. You know, some people are in great marriages at work. You know, when you go to parties, you look at two people and you think, you know, those people click. And you go home and maybe you're warmed by the thought of those people. And those people may or may not ever write a book about how they've done it. But there are also many parties you've been at where you look at those two people and you think, you know, they don't click. And that happened to me in my case, where I was deeply, deeply in love with someone with whom I did not get along with a lot of the time, or with whom I had a lot of struggles. And so that became my beat.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is James Brawley. He's an author and performer. His new book is called Life in a Marital Institution, 20 Years of Monogamy in One Terrifying Memoir. If you have a question, comment for James Brawley, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Life in a Marital Institution is set against the backdrop of your larger family and at the deathbed of your beloved sister, Kate, who sounded marvelous. Why did you decide to tell it that way?
Well, it's interesting. Initially, the structure was kind of sequential. First meeting, first date, on to the final story of my sister on her deathbed. And it's at that moment that you realize life is, you know, is short, and she's getting married to her third husband, and I'm trying to stay there as long as I can at the hospice and not go back to face my marriage, and ultimately I do. And as I performed that structure in New York in anticipation of premiering it in Edinburgh at the Fringe Festival, it became kind of evident to me, I can't. Now, lights up, a room full of strangers, nobody knows anything about me. I just can't perform. I can't stand on this structure. It really became a kind of visceral awareness of how I was going to communicate with an audience. And I thought, I need to frame this in the context of my reunion with my sister and my family, because we hadn't seen each other many, many years, in some cases 40 years. Some of these people had not seen each other. That would be an engaging frame for this material that I wanted to explore. So it really, it was not even an intellectual or artistic decision as much as it was a visceral performance decision to structure it that way.
She asks you, she was a pretty funny person, and, you know, you mentioned brilliant and so many other things, but she asks you when you're visiting her if you would trade places with her, if you loved her enough, would you trade places with her if you could? And could you tell us about that?
Yeah. You know, it's a scary moment for all the obvious reasons when you know, my sister was 5 years older than I was and had been through many, many you know, husbands, wives, languages, jobs, countries, an amazing resilience and capacity to reinvent herself. And when it seemed like the end, you know, it was shocking because she seemed like the last person who would die prematurely. So I'm down in the hospice visiting her, sitting in her room, holding her hand, telling her I love her over and over again. And she's on Dilaudid, you know, which is this super high-powered anesthetic or painkiller that they don't even give you in the hospital because your heart can stop very easily in the hospice. It's just, you know, we want to make you comfortable. And so I don't even know whether she's awake. Turns out she is. She opens her eyes and says in so many words, you know, that's easy for you to say, but do you love me enough to trade places? And that's a very, very shocking moment because, of course, the answer is no. You know, the only person who I do love enough to trade places with in that situation are my kids. And, you know, maybe my wife on good days, and there haven't been that many of them. And so I'm scrambling for an explanation, an answer to her question, and then it hits me. Well, would you trade places with me? I'll be in your deathbed if you'll be in my marriage. She mulls that over for a moment and says in so many words, I'd rather die. And soon enough, she does. So it really happened. And, you know, there's a kind of gallows humor. You may not be surprised to hear that happens in a hospice situation like that. And also her most developed pronounced quality was humor. She had a brilliant, brilliant sense of humor to the point that her oncologist came to me at one point and said he was writing a book on the relationship between humor and life enhancement, that she had lived, she'd far outlived his other patients with the same prognosis, same type of cancer, same stage, et cetera, which he attributed largely to her sense of humor.
I, even still, Jane, or Kate, including and the rest of your family, made me feel sorry for Jane at a certain level because none of them liked her. And I guess I bonded with that, with her over that. I felt sorry for her.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I felt sorry for her. They didn't like her, and I don't know how you felt about that.
Well, it's an interesting point. You know, when you go back through the annals of marriage and history and you marry someone, connect with someone who your family doesn't support, you know, you can, you know, there's examples at the top of the food chain with, you know, Edward and, you know, abdicating to marry Wallace Simpson and so forth. And what, you know, why is that and what havoc can it wreak on your relationship? So in my case, I had a family who, you know, one of the themes that the book explores and that the show explores is that love is what love was. The reason that you end up in a situation that's difficult is because you came from a situation that's difficult. And that's ultimately, that's how I developed the show and developed the book once I became more conscious of using that structure, that this is a chaotic backdrop. That you know, this was the school of love. This is my school of love. And, you know, I learned my lessons, graduate and go and create my own kind of chaos. The initial stage of that relationship was going to my girlfriend, then wife, and saying, look back at my family with me. Do you see what I see? And she would say, absolutely. They are as chaotic as you think they are. So one of our bonds was a shared understanding, you know, and a mutual belief that my family was as, you know, as troubled as I thought they were. And then, you know, based on the fact that I started in a troubled place, I ended up creating a troubled relationship, at which point I go back to my family and say, is my marriage as troubled as you as I think it is? And they would affirm that. So I found myself going back and forth between these two poles, you know, looking for affirmation of something that seemed, you know, extremely hard to accept. And they would, you know, affirm my point of view one against the other. And now, that having been said, there were connections between Jane and my mom in particular, which I don't really get into in the book as much, because she, you know, one of her goals, my mom's goals in life, was to be the world's best mother-in-law, because she'd had the world's worst mother-in-law, so she claimed. And so for many years, my mom was our de facto marriage counselor.
Well, that's saying a lot, because I've never read about anyone having as many marriage counselors as you two had.
Yeah, we had a lot. Now, some of those were, you know, as I illustrate in the book, some of them are just single meetings, and some of them are for, you know, 6 months or a year. The thing is, in New York, now this may be different now in New York State, and it may be different in other parts of the country, but you don't have to be licensed to be a marriage counselor. You have to be licensed to be a psychotherapist, and you have to be licensed to get to offer insurance reimbursement, you know, mm-hmm. to qualify with health insurers. But you can hang up a shingle and counsel people. I mean, it's, people in churches do it all the time without any special training.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these people who you would walk into, whose offices you would walk into, would be just like visibly disturbed, and you don't know that until you get there. so they're trying to figure their situation out,
right,
as well.
I thought it was interesting how often they united you in you were united against them more than anything therapeutic happening.
Well, you know, years ago, I remember walking down the street in New York and turning a corner. New York was a very different place than, you know, lots of, you know, much more open kind of Wild West criminal behavior happening on the street, robberies and break-ins and so forth, and domestic violence cases or spats just right out there on the sidewalk. And at one point, I'm walking down the street and I see this guy kind of manhandling his girlfriend, wife, whatever, and I, you know, sort of walk nearby, and I say, you know, where's the effect of, you know, you really shouldn't be doing that. And she looks at me and says, "Stay out." And they bonded, the two of them, against me. So this is not uncommon, you know, when something threatens a couple, it's, you know, you hear stories all the time about a girlfriend, you know, a girlfriend will find out that another girlfriend's husband or boyfriend or whatever is, you know, cheating on her. And, you know, the girlfriend who has the knowledge will go to the girlfriend who's being, whose marriage or relationship or whatever is being threatened and say, "Hey, I heard this or that." And sometimes that's enough to end the friendship between those girlfriends.
It's funny the way you describe that situation on the street. It reminds me of the time my brother tried to do the same thing at a Rolling Stones concert, and the woman almost bit his finger off.
Wow. So, yeah. Well, that could have been.
Back. Look what I brought back from the Rolling Stones.
The MDA
It was quite a mark of valor, I guess. My guest is James Brawley. He is an author and performer, and his new book is called Life in a Marital Institution, 20 Years of Monogamy in One Terrifying Memoir. If you have a question or comment for James, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the Guantanamo horror show, prisoners on a hunger strike, and big questions about justice and what to do with the detainees. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 here on 89.7 NPR News. Does the Constitution have what it takes to keep up with modern America? Watch Constitution USA with Peter Sagal, Tuesday night at 9 on WOSU-TV. 55 degrees with a really good chance of rain off and on throughout the day today, a high near 70. Still a slight chance of rain tonight and a low of 54. And a chance of rain sticks around for Tuesday, a high of 73. Support for 89.7 comes from Green Bean Delivery, offering home delivery of fresh organic produce and natural groceries, striving to make healthy eating more accessible to the communities of Greater Columbus. Details on Green Bean Delivery's products, as well as how to place an order, can be found online at greenbeandelivery.com. And support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is James Brawley. He's an author, performer. His new book is called Life in a Marital Institution, 20 Years of Monogamy in One Terrifying Memoir. We're talking with James right now about that. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. James, I read that the hardest parts of the memoir for you were both cut from the final version.
Oh, that's interesting. Where did you read that?
I don't know. In some of that PR material. <It's> like,
that was meaningless.
Some Q&A.
That I thought I should have read to begin with.
It was
another lie.
It had to do about, I don't know, something about the end of the relationship with your wife, or the end, or the day you signed your agreement to separate.
Oh, the separation agreement.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I did cut that from, yes, I cut that from the memoir. But that was going to be an epilogue, and at that time, I've since sort of decoded how to make it work as a story, which I performed actually a couple of weeks ago at the Moth in New York City. But at the time that I was finishing the book, I could not figure out how to make that episode. I could not figure out how to make that story work as a story. It was coming out as an essay. And that, which is very different than my book. You know, my book is a story, and it's a memoir. It's not an essay, and there's a big difference. And I just couldn't make it work that way. So that's why I pulled it.
Breastfeeding is a frequent topic in the book. Your two children both breastfed until they were, well, I'm not sure how old when they finally quit. I was wondering
they were both outfielders at the time.
Actually, one of them was a pitcher. Well, the last one, where I left off, one was 4 and one was 6. So, what kind of flack have you received for your depictions of the breastfeeding in the book? And that's by anyone's measure, pretty much almost anyone. That's a long time to be breastfeeding. What kind of pushback have you been getting, if any?
Pushback for having written the views that I wrote?
Yes.
Well, let's see. Among probably the most piquant pushback I got was, I think you should be chemically castrated.
Okay.
for objecting to that. And, you know, there are, I guess the underlying thesis or point that I'm trying to make, that I've tried to make, and I've done it in the book, but I've also done it in the piece that I did in the New York Times, is that at a certain point, it's the woman's relationship with the kids, her body, she can do with it as she wishes with the kid up to a certain point. And then it becomes a family decision. And maybe that's 3 years old, maybe it's at 4. In my view, definitely if a mother is breastfeeding the kid at 5 and the husband's not cool with it, I think that she's either got to get him on board or wean the kid. And back to your question, that was the sharpest feedback that I've gotten. Some other, positive feedback that I've gotten along those lines is, yes, totally. This should have stopped, before the teeth fell out, before they went bilingual. Any kid who can run across a room, unbutton his mom's blouse, and request, you know, breast milk in two or more languages should have been weaned one language ago.
I guess, you know, the castration thing was to be expected. There's nothing really surprising that someone would say something like that. Have you gotten any, has anyone mounted any official protests, or has it otherwise been just that?
Just been, some stalkers. I've gotten a few stalkers. Mm. And what was interesting, you know, one of the most interesting dimensions of that brouhaha over that particular issue, because I mean, basically the way that my career has developed, the way that my book works, the way that my show works is comic. I'm a seemingly, you know, normal guy who's going to take you on an adventure, on a tour of something that's very extreme. And in that extreme, along the way, you'll see things about yourself and your relationship that you recognize. Mm-hmm. One of the operating theories that I had behind writing a kind of tongue-in-cheek but sort of outrageous piece on breastfeeding, now that you're mentioning it, was to test the tolerance on the left and try to compare it against the seeming intolerance on the right. And what I found is that at the edges of the political spectrum, left and right, and the intolerance is essentially the same. The vociferous, antagonistic, negative comments chemically castrate the guy, for example, mm-hmm. were to me, you know, and this is coming from somebody who thinks that they are, you know, they describe themselves as liberal. And, you know, I found that very, very, you know, illuminating and interesting.
I thought it was interesting that this relationship, this was something that you decided on almost instantaneously when you met your wife, that you were going to marry her, that this was it.
Yes.
Love at first
sight.
Loved
her, was bonded with her, was attracted to her instantly.
Yeah, and there was a lot of other references to, and almost instantly she was wearing the, what do you call it, the pants in the family, or how, whatever kind of, I don't know if euphemism is the right
metaphor,
word.
Metaphor, yeah.
Metaphor, right, yeah, right.
Well, however you want to describe the opposite of being an alpha male.
Yeah.
No, I was alpha in some ways, but it was beta in others. You know, she was and is 3 or so years older than I am. And had been through, you know, she was a scholarship kid. She lived around the world. She spoke a lot of languages. So she could do things, good things that I did. And so I, you know, but that having been said, our paths, you know, the trajectories that our respective trajectories changed very, very quickly when we started dating. Because I saw that to hold her, I mean, there we are, we're in New York City at Columbia, lots of kind of high achievers, and I could see that to hold her, I would have to be a high achiever. And by the same token, she did not feel the pressure to achieve at the level that she had been achieving before, which had gotten her the scholarships and the housing subsidies and all the rest of it from the various universities that mm-hmm. she'd been at. So that was a role reversal in some ways.
There are a lot of characters in your book, and we don't have enough time to go over all of them, unfortunately. But I have to say one of my favorites, I don't know if you'll like me anymore or not, or if you do at all, was your dad. I mean, all I can picture is at the wedding, at your son, your sister's deathbed, there he is in his gold stretch pants with a houndstooth jacket on, and I'm thinking, I gotta like this guy.
Oh, my dad is an awesome character. He was Eisenhower's pilot.
Right.
When Eisenhower was coming out of Korea and flown around the world and decorated bomber pilot and was a huge Roger Miller, the country star fan, so dressed kind of like him with the aviator sunglasses and had real visceral power. You know, my dad had, and I never understood, you know, my parents were divorced when I was very, very young, and I never, 4 or 5 years old, and I never really understood, boy, what brought them together? Because my mom had a succession of husbands afterwards, and her fourth and final husband was a very focused businessman. He was an oil man. He wore very nice clothes, perfectly groomed, the, you know, pays his taxes months in advance, the kind of guy you want, you know, running the family, but not particularly interesting or charismatic guy. And nevertheless, she chose him. And when I graduated from college, my mom and my stepfather were there, and my father had flown out to see me graduate. And I'd never seen them in a room together, ever, my father and my mother. And my father walked into the room where the rest of us were assembled, and this is the first time that I had seen the two of them in the same space at the same time. And he walks towards my mom, and my mom is standing there next to her husband, who's holding a plastic cup, graduation cup of red wine. My father walks up, and my stepfather's wine starts to tremble in his hand, and then he crunches the glass of plastic, the plastic cup of wine. It spills all over his shoes, and my father just kind of looks at him, has this sort of bemused alpha male smile. And my mom looks at my dad, and then kind of bows her head like a little swan, and looks up and says, "Hello, stranger." And that's the moment I understood his power, what brought them together, and his visceral power within the context of a relationship with her. And plus, he has this amazing Alabama, Huntsville baritone, slight twang, but not super thick. And so it's very sonorous and beautiful to listen to. And he really is the reason why I became a storyteller as much as anything else, because I was exposed to him on alternate weekends as a kid telling stories. So I have a firsthand experience of somebody who can hold a room to the same degree that a movie can, or a book can, or a rock concert can, or whatever. My dad, in the full flower of his storytelling powers, was a fully engaging entertainment form.
I haven't been to Texas very many times, but you don't sound like you're from Texas.
No, well, I was born in Texas, the youngest of four, and 6 months after I came along, we moved to California.
Okay.
So we were kind of, Texas Bedouins, I had lots of salsa and chips in the house growing up, although I suppose they eat those naturally in California as well, but nevertheless, we'd always be searching for enchiladas when we're out in the car looking for restaurants to eat at. So it was, I'm a transplanted Texan in that regard. And then I became a transplanted Californian because we moved to Colorado when I was 8 or 9. And then I moved to New York, and that's where, for college, and that's where I stayed.
And that's what you sound like. Now, Jane is one thing, but your sister Corinne is another altogether. Your older sister Corinne, you always refer to her with the eyes, with the undiagnosed or untreated. What is it? What's the...
Oh, the hyperthyroid.
Hyperthyroidism. I can just visualize this. It's terrible, but I can visualize
Peter,
it.
Yes, if Peter Laurie were a beauty queen. Although she's since, gotten treatment for that. Now she's back to her beautiful self.
So what does she make of the book?
That's an interesting question. I when I did the show, she was there for opening night in New York off Broadway, and I was very, very wary about what she'd say as I got off stage. And in so many words, she said, "I can't believe how many stories you did about Jane. Why didn't you tell more about me?" Exactly. She was totally cool with my portrayal of her. And this is the nature of being a monologuist and being a storyteller. There's a great story by David Sedaris on this, where he visits his sister, one of his sisters, on a book tour, and it's clear he's doing very well. It's clear she isn't. And this whole story that he's telling is in large part about how well she's not doing. And at the end of the story, he walks into the corner of the living room and pulls the curtain off of the parrot. And they say, "I'm sorry," to each other. And he's sorry for the fact that this is what he has to do to make a living. He has to expose, he's using real people living real lives as the basis of characters and stories. And my sister understands that's what I do. It's a peculiar gift, if you want to call it that. But if you've ever read David Sedaris' fiction, for example, and compared it to his essays, there's really no comparison.
No. No, you know, completely different.
The essays are just orders of magnitude more interesting. And if that's your, you know, your beat, your path or whatever, it can be hard on the people around you.
Although he's incredibly chilling edge to some of his fiction, too. It's an interesting comparison. You've received lots of praise for the book, its candor and humor, which is what we've just been talking about, but some criticism too for telling too much about your family, for putting your kids out there especially. How do you balance that in your mind, the sharing and the expose, and are you changing your children's names?
Yes, I am changing their names. My children, because of the way they grew up, they didn't read for a while, and that did not, because of my, I'm slow on the uptake, it didn't occur to me that one day they would be able to read. But ultimately, as I finished the book, I realized, yes, one day they will be able to read. They'll be able to read this, and they will read this. So I was very careful about, I want to tell my story, you know, on the one hand, but B, these are primary relationships, and that's a primary job, being a father. So the position I took was, and I had a discussion with my kids the other night about this, actually. I don't tell anything the only secrets I reveal in my book are my own. So breastfeeding kids till whenever, burying human organs in the backyard, on and on. These things are not secrets. They're not family secrets. They're not dirty laundry. My perspective on those things is something that maybe my kids didn't know about, maybe my wife didn't know about, whatever. Observation, the analysis, that's my own.
Okay.
And my family members, for example, my perspective on my sister's, you know, thyroid eyes or whatever, she may not know that I thought that. But, you know, anybody who has seen her can, you know, in the past, before she got medication for it, well, it was self-evident.
It worked. James Brawley, author and performer, thank you so much for joining us today. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you very much, and I really appreciate it.
James Brawley, his new book is called Life in a Marital Institution, 20 Years of Monogamy in One Terrifying Memoir. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.